This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Today on Dreamland, we're going to have Scott Creighton, and we're going to be talking about a very important book filled with new discoveries, The Great Pyramid Void Enigma, The Mystery of the Hall of the Ancestors. We now know that it's there. We know this. But what does it mean? And what does it have to do with our era and beyond? Because it turns out maybe a great deal, and it's important to understand this. Scott Creighton is an engineer. He has traveled many ancient sacred sites. He's been on Ancient Aliens, Coast to Coast. He's the host of an alternative Egyptology forum on Above Top Secret. And he has been on Dreamland a number of times, I believe. He is the author also of The Great Pyramid Hoax. Scott, welcome to Dreamland.
Hi, Whitley. It's very good to be here. Pleased to meet you again.
Yes, it is good. And this book is explosive. I have got pages and pages of notes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I read. As my listeners know, I think I'm one of the few hosts who actually reads books that they interview people about, because most of them do a good job. But it's not this type of job.
Yeah.
All right. Now, let's start by talking about the scan team and its findings and what it was and what they were doing, if you can explain that to us.
Okay, well, quickly, in November, I think it was November 2017, a group of around 30 scientists from all over the world published their research in the famous journal Nature. I'm sure you're probably quite familiar with that particular journal. Now, after 2 years of studying the Great Pyramid using a scientific technique known as muon tomography, it's kind of like taking an X-ray of the Great Pyramid and or the Great Pyramid's interior, I should say. The Scan Pyramids team announced the discovery of a massive, hitherto unknown space, or void, as they call it, deep inside the Great Pyramid. Now, just to let you understand, or your viewers and listeners understand, Whitley, this space that they've discovered is as big as the Grand Gallery, which is about, 100 foot long, 30 foot wide, 30 foot high, I should say. And the Grand Gallery sits about 15 feet below this void space. So we can imagine the Grand Gallery goes through the pyramid at a sort of 26 degree angle, maybe something like that. I'm showing with my pen here. And the big void. Now, they don't know if the big void is at a similar angle. The big void sits above it like that, okay? So they're not sure if the big void is angled like the Grand Gallery or if it is, in fact, level like that. I'm just showing here with my two pens. So anyway, now, Egyptology is, when it was discovered, Egyptologists were kind of reluctant to speak about it because, essentially, they don't know what this space is. They don't consider it likely to be a chamber because there's no passage, or the Scan Pyramids team did not detect any passages to or from this void, this space. So it seems to be entirely cut off from the rest of the pyramid structures inside the pyramid. Some people believe that the space may not actually exist, that it's just an error, a data error in the scan pyramid's data, that it may have been receiving a ghost image, if you like, of the Grand Gallery itself, a sort of reflection image that their data somehow managed to pick up. And so to eliminate that possibility that what they were seeing was some kind of reflection or ghost image, the Scan Pyramid team undertook a new series of scans in 2019. And in those new scans, they were able to truly confirm the presence of this big void. It's real. It's big, and it's there.
So we now know that it's there. And over the course of this show, folks, we're going to be talking about what it is and why it's there. But we are also going to be talking about something that is intimately connected with it, which is, we will call it pole shift, but it is much more complex than that. There is something about planet Earth that they experienced and to a great degree understood and left us information about not only what it was and what happened, but also about when it would happen again. And in the third half hour, we'll get into that latter part. Now, I want to go back to the Coptic texts that you reference in your book that do discuss the various things that, well, no, before that, let's go back to the Grand Gallery and talk about what may have been in the Grand Gallery in the days that of the pharaohs, and where those, what remains of those objects may be now. I think it's a very interesting story.
Yeah, well, the Grand Gallery is a very peculiar chamber within the Great Pyramid. There's nothing else like the Grand Gallery in any other pyramid. I mean, it's absolutely ginormous. It's huge. Absolutely huge. As I said, it's about 100 feet long and about 13 feet high, about 10, 15 feet wide, something like that. And as I said, Egyptologists, they really don't know why the Grand Gallery is there. It's just some ceremonial procession way for the king, you know, leading up to the final chamber at the top of the Grand Gallery, which is the king's burial chamber, which connects to the Grand Gallery via a small antechamber. So that's the alternative view. It's some sort of procession way, grand procession way for the king, which in a whole number of ways really, really doesn't make any sense. But along each side of the Grand Gallery, there are what are called the pavements or the sidewalks for an American audience. And these pavements, sidewalks, have, each one is about probably about 2 feet wide. And they go either side of the Grand Gallery from the bottom all the way to the very top of the Grand Gallery. And inside, cut into these pavements, are what are called the notches. And these notches are about 2.5 to 3 feet wide. They're about 8 to 10 inches deep and about 6 to 8 inches depth. So Egyptology, again, they don't know what the purpose of these notches are. There's 27 of them, Whitley. There's 27 of these notches on either side of the Grand Gallery. That makes a total of 54 of them altogether. And as I said, Egyptology has no idea what these are. Now, there was, I think it was a physicist, a guy called André Pochan. And back in the 1970s, he came up with a theory for what these 54 notches actually were. And this theory is linked to some of the Coptic Egyptian texts that have come down to us that were translated in early medieval times by some Arabic scholars such as Al-Masudi, Al-Makrizi and so forth and so on. Various Arabic scholars translated these Coptic texts or oral traditions, actually. And what they said was that when the early explorers, like Al-Mamun, blasted his way into the pyramid in medieval times, I think it was about 800, something like that, AD, something like that, he discovered statues within the Grand Gallery on either side, all the way to the top. And what I suspect and what Pochan suspected was that these notches were basically slots into which these 54 statues of Khufu's ancestors were situated. This is how they were fixed into this pavement so that they wouldn't slide or move.
Yes.
Because remember, it's angled at 26.5 degrees. So they would need these notches on these pavements. There was also grooves cut into the wall a couple of feet up each, above each of these notches, so that there was obviously some fixing mechanism on the actual statue itself. Some kind of boss which would be embedded into the wall, again, to keep the statue secure. So this is what André Pochan thought these notches and grooves were for. And as I said, it is backed up by some of these ancient Coptic Egyptian texts that say there were statues of Khufu's ancestors within this chamber.
So these texts should be respected, but they're considered fanciful, folks, by the Egyptologists. We're going to get into the texts because we have reason to believe just from this that the texts are accurate. These texts, it's a Coptic Egyptian oral tradition that tells us the stars wandered confusedly from their courses. So you say in chapter 3 of your book, Wandering Stars. All right. What happened? Well, rather than making it too open-ended like this, let's talk about the various different types of pole shift. Now, we're not talking here, folks, about magnetic pole shift, which is very definitely a known phenomenon and seems to be setting up to happen at the present time, although how long from now, we don't know. This is other types of pole shift. And let me read you a few quotes. This is from Isaiah 24. Behold, the Lord maketh the earth empty and maketh it waste and turneth it upside down. The earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard, and it shall fall and not rise again. That's from Isaiah. From Amos 8, and it shall come to pass that in that day, saith the Lord God, that I will cause the sun to go down at noon, and I will darken the earth in the clear day. Very dramatic statements. Has it happened and will it happen again, Scott?
I believe it has happened. I absolutely, genuinely believe it has happened because, yes, as you read out those particular passages from the Bible, there are many, many other ancient texts from societies and civilizations all over the world that speak of this event occurring in ancient times. You know, whether it's you know, the indigenous populations of Greenland, whether it's the indigenous populations of North America and Canada, whether it's the South America, China, we hear these stories of the earth turning over, of the stars moving out of their normal course, of the sun rising in the west and setting in the east. All these different pole shift phenomena are recorded by our ancient ancestors, and they have been committed to texts. And yeah, I absolutely believe that the monuments at Giza were actually designed partly because of this, but they actually show us the pole shift actually happening and exactly what happened to Giza, that part of the world, during this pole shift event. So yeah, I absolutely do believe that this happened in the past, and it's happened, as you know, Whitley, since you've read the book, it's happened at least twice.
Well, in recent, it must have happened thousands of times over the life of the Earth.
Yeah. Now, in recent times, you know, in the last processional cycle, I think this event occurs twice within every 26,000 years.
What's interesting about that is that you don't mention it in the book, but there's some strange supporting evidence that there was a cycle, that this happened around 5,000, roughly 5,000 BC. And I say roughly because what I'm going to talk about doesn't have the most specific dating. One thing is this, the Utsi, the Iceman, who was running through a forest glade in the Tyrolean Alps when he died, was killed, fell, and snow began, and it snowed, and it snowed, and it snowed. And the forest glade never thawed out again. It became a glacier instead. Now, at the same approximate time, and I have to say approximate here, Professor Lonnie Thompson, who is a glaciologist, analyzed glaciers in the Andes and found that at the base of these glaciers, which he dated to about the same period, there was quick frozen deciduous plants. In other words, these plants had been frozen so quickly that they were like something you would buy in a grocery store from the freezer. The cells weren't damaged. They were absolutely frozen almost instantaneously. Now, you put those two things together, and you see that at that time, something extraordinary was happening on planet Earth. Yeah. And I think you know what it was, Scott.
Yeah, I mean, there's also, I'm sure you're very well aware, Whitley, of the research of Professor Charles Hapgood in the 1940s and 1950s. And, you know, he managed to uncover a ton of evidence, which he presents in his book, Earth's Shifting Crust, and his later book, The Path of the Pole. And honestly, it's just inconceivable to me how science is able to find a way to somehow discredit the an incredible amount of research that Hapgood did. I mean, even Albert Einstein accepted the possibility that, you know, the Earth, could have pole shifts, whether the turnover, whether it's just a crust or whatever. But Einstein himself accepted Hapgood's argument, and I think he even wrote the foreword to Hapgood's book. You know, so it's really just about trying to find the mechanism, what makes this thing happen, because I genuinely do believe, after the research that I've been undertaking for the last, I've been interested in this topic probably for about 20 years, but probably more seriously interested in it in the last 10 years or so. So, yeah, I genuinely do believe that the research of all these different scientists that uncover these incredible anomalies, you know, of woolly mammoths, you know, that have been flash frozen in a part of the world, which, you know, it just shouldn't have happened, you know. Right. You know, so it's like all these different things. There's another, I'm not sure if you're aware of the chap Mark Gaffney. He's produced recently some amazing evidence using, I think, mollusks. That obviously exist in the ocean. And these mollusks are very temperature-sensitive creatures. And he shows how suddenly this particular type of mollusk suddenly moves something like 1,600 or 2,000 miles to a different habitat, you know, with the temperature, you know, was different. But was it different, or was it the pole shift that, you know, yes, actually,
well, if it was an axial shift, if the planet moved, speaking of movement, folks, free Dreamlanders, make the move to subscribe to unknowncountry.com. do it now. For you, we will be right back. We're talking to Scott Creighton. His new book is quite incredible. The Great Pyramid Void Enigma, The Mystery of the Hall of the Ancestors. Scott has basically cracked the code about pole shift and also come to understand what is likely to be in this void that we now know is there. There's no question about it anymore. It is there. And there are plans being made to explore it, of course. So, Scott, but let's now go back to this such a remarkable situation. I would like to just mention in passing that Scott has a list in this book from Emanuel Velikovsky's 1950 book, Worlds in Collision, which was far more important than people gave it credit for at the time. It is a list of all kinds of statements about this, ranging from the Romans to the Eskimos, about statements about this movement of the planet happening. And they're not contemporary with the movement of the planet, but they are memories of something that were passed down from person to person. And disrespecting those memories and that type of information passage is disrespecting mankind and disrespecting the past and trying to impose a belief system on the narrative. And we were just getting into why that might be. And I thought, I don't want to deal with it too much because we're here to inform, not to whine about the failures of science, about the reason I think is summed up beautifully in an all-time classic by Barbara Hand Clow called Catastrophobia, where she offers the theory that we are traumatized because we live on a planet that is particularly prone to sudden and extraordinary overturning of of its normally very placid and regular life. And this is supported by Hamlet's Mill, also a great book that everyone should have in their library. But Barbara Hand Klaus says that there's a psychological block people can't handle the truth. And I think that extends to the conventional scientific and Egyptological communities. They don't want to face the reality. How do you respond to that?
Well, I absolutely agree with it. I mean, I think partly as well, Whitley, it's you know, to do with, you know, there's this atmosphere built up within the scientific community that to believe in such radical, I put that in quotes, radical or scare quotes, radical ideas, you know, you could end up being, you know, the butt of all the jokes and ridiculed. You know, so there's a certain sense of fear there for a lot of people in the scientific community. I've got a great respect for the scientific community, but I think they're hamstrung by their own discipline to a large extent. I think, but, you know, one of the interesting things which is starting to emerge, is starting to change, is the science of geomythology. And it was, I think it was discovered in the, or it started to formulate in the 1970s by a geologist called Dorothy Vitaliano. And what she basically argued as a scientist is that a lot of the world's myths and legends most likely have a basis in truth, which relates to you know, some kind of earth changes, whether it's of a geological nature, an astronomical nature, or even a paleontological nature. She argues that all these strange occurrences in the sky or even on land or within geology of the earth can be accounted for, like a volcano erupting is, you know, described as, you know, some incredible act of the gods, and all manner of ancient myths, you know, the serpent in the sky, the dragon in the sky, you know, is perhaps some comet passing close to the earth. You know, so she realized that all these things could actually, these myths and legends actually contain kernels of truth, kernels of fact. And the way she puts it is that the science of geomythology turns mythology back into history. That's the way she puts it. And it's good to see, because more and more scientists are actually, now, it's an emerging science. It's not like totally mainstream, but it has now emerged into mainstream science, the study of these ancient myths to find what actually really happened in the past. And I think that really, really is important. And more scientists are starting. There's reluctance, there's hesitance, but because geomythology has got an ology on the end of it, it becomes scientific. So that's okay. That's permitted. That's allowed. We can study that. So it's allowing scientists to engage in a field where latterly they probably dared not dip their toes.
Well, that's good news for certain, yeah, because the past has a great deal to teach us about the future. And it's time we started trying to seriously find out. And by the way, folks, if you want to try to seriously find out right now, get the Great Pyramid Void Enigma. It is a really a treasure. I think it's the best worked out book on these type of earth changes that's ever been written. And I've read them all. I've read them, every one of them. And I've even read one. It was published in first published in 1954. That is referenced in your book, and I want to talk about it a little bit now. It's called The Adam and Eve Story, folks. And when it was first published, it was classified and withdrawn due to the CIA's intervention, and now was republished in 1993 in a there will be a link to it online on the show so that you can easily click through to it and read it. But can you tell us a little bit about this book? And if you know, and I personally do not know, what parts of it were classified?
Well, I wish I knew which parts were classified, Whitley, because the parts that weren't classified themselves really raise, you know, your eyebrows. You're like, whoa, what? You know, some of Chan Thomas's ideas are just totally mind-blowing and utterly explosive.
Well, tell us a little bit about Chan Thomas's ideas.
Well, he basically, I think he's very much along similar lines to other catastrophists, you know, who have gone before him, like Ignatius Donnelly and people like that. He believes that mankind has gone through so many, many cycles. I think it is about four or five cycles that he suggests. You know, like Noah and the Ark and Adam and Eve, Noah and the Ark, Isis and Osiris, you know, all these different icons, you know, ancient icons that we read about in the Bible and, you know, pyramid lore and, you know, the pyramid texts of the ancient Egyptians. They were actually different incarnations are the survivors of these post-shifts events that keep occurring or reoccurring post-shift events. And I think he reckoned that they occur something like every 3,600 years, something of that order. You know, so that's the basis of his general idea, is that these historical figures that we read of are actually different ages of man, you know, across tens of thousands of years. And they were the survivors, if you like, of these cataclysms, or one of the survivors anyway. And the thing about his ideas is he was probably one of the very first that I think came up with some credible mechanism for these pole shift events to occur. And that is basically by proposing that at the core of the Earth, the core of the Earth explodes basically after, you know, I think 3,600 years. And that explosion deep within the core of the Earth, it's like a pulse, you know, a pulse explosion, just boom, nuclear explosion in the core of the Earth. And that explosion essentially heats up the interior core of the Earth, and basically liquefying the interior mantle of the Earth, which to essentially a liquid. And that is what he believes allows the Earth to, or the crust of the Earth, the outer shell of the Earth, to move over the inner core, the inner body of the Earth. And as this liquid cools down and, you know, it solidifies again and basically it stops the sliding motion of the crust over the Earth. So that essentially is you know, Chan Thomas's theory in a nutshell.
So he had an insight that someone in the intelligence community thought should be hidden, and that says something about it, I think. And it's very disturbing because there are dates in the book. And it suggests that this is not far, that another one of these events is not far off. But before we get into that, free Dreamlanders. Take another break and enjoy yourself. Have a cup of coffee or say the rosary or something, because you'll be waiting for a good long time before we get back. We're back. We're talking to Scott Creighton. His book, The Great Pyramid Void Enigma, The Mystery of the Hall of the Ancestors. And the book goes beyond that. And we're going to find out, by the way, later, what probably is in that hall. And it's going to be a very surprising part of the show, believe you me, folks. Now, let's go back to what we found in the book we were just discussing. And the interesting thing is that his title is a little strange, and it reminded me a little bit of a book that that Linda Moulton Howe looked for years, called Ancient Greek Gods and Their Lore Revisited, that was allegedly pulled by the CIA, and no copies have ever been found. The Adam and Eve story, it's not about Adam and Eve. It's about something entirely different. And yet at the same time, it is a sort of a revisionist creation myth, isn't it?
Yeah, that's. I mean, it's a while ago since I read that book, but yeah, that essentially is my impression of it as well. It's almost like an allegory of the Bible itself. The stories in the Bible. Some people think many of the stories in the Bible are allegorical. Well, this particular work of Chan Thomas, that seems to be an allegory of an allegory. It's really, really well done, and I think it does particularly the mechanism was the thing that fascinated me most, because that was the thing that you always come up against a brick wall with. Well, how could this actually happen, you know? But then, Whitley just sort of went off at a tangent here. How can this happen? How can the Earth just go like that, rapidly?
Let's talk a little bit about the different forms of pole shift. But before we, and then we're going to go down another road, but tell us a little bit about the different forms of what where the Earth would move on its axis or move in some way and reorient itself.
Yeah. Well, you've essentially got three sort of types of pole shift. Now, I think in the past, most people writers, researchers have suggested that there's only two, but there's actually three. And the first one is fairly straightforward. It's one that probably most people will be familiar with, and that is just simply the ball of the Earth, the rotating ball of the Earth, simply turns over 180 degrees in space, Earth, rotational axis, and everything. Now, with that type of pole shift, the Earth turns completely upside down with its rotational axis. Nothing has actually moved anywhere. If we moved, let's say we moved, turned over 180 degrees just now, Whitley, the Earth did that right now. Well, the North Pole would become the South Pole would become the North Pole, but they would still be in the polar regions. There would be no difference. Right. The latitudes wouldn't change at all, because the latitudes of the Earth only change when the pole of the Earth, changes relative to the Earth's ground mass. Imagine you have a ball of clay and you put a rod through it, like a long knitting needle. You put it through your ball of clay and you just tip it round. Well, nothing changes relative to the pole. So everywhere will have the same climate that it currently has, including the poles. They'll still be in the polar regions. The temperate regions will still be in the temperate zones and so forth and so on. However, if you take your ball of clay and actually move the needle through the clay, yeah, and that becomes your new rotational axis, then what you have is every part of the Earth has moved to a different geophysical location relative to the pole. So if you move nearer to the pole, then as the pole moves through the clay, it's moving closer to you, then you're actually moving into the polar region. And likewise, if you're moving further away from the pole, then you're moving into warmer latitudes. So that essentially is a kind of simple way of trying to envisage this. Now, the next type of pole shift, that first one was just a straight axial tilt. The Earth and the pole, the polar axis turn together. The next type of pole shift is where the axis remains fixed in space relative to the fixed stars. The axis, the rotation, the Earth's rotational axis remains fixed. And what actually happens is that the upper crust of the Earth just basically slides through the axis. But it will do so, it would have to do so to maintain the laws of the conservation of angular momentum. So it would have to do that in a spiral. Yeah. So that is how the Earth can actually move through. If you imagine the pole is fixed, yeah, the actual rotational axis of the pole. I'm not talking about the North Pole. Imagine this pole extended out into space like a rod, and the Earth, the ball of the Earth, is in the middle. What you've got is the crust of the Earth is actually moving through this pole, which is fixed. And so then what you have is the poles moving to different locations and the temperate zones moving to different locations because, you know, the pole is fixed and they're all moving away from the pole or towards the pole. And in this particular scenario with the Earth sliding over, as Hapgood suggested, the Earth sliding over the inner core, you can, you know, you can get a full 180-degree turn of the Earth using that particular method. Some people call it Earth crust displacement, true polar wander, although it's not actually the pole that wanders, it's the Earth itself that wanders. Scientists say this occurs like, you know, less than half a degree, you know, every million years or so that this shift occurs. But the evidence, as far as I'm concerned, shows this these pole shifts occur as true polar wander occurs much more rapidly. Now, in that second example that I showed that I told you about there with the Earth, this ECD, Earth crust displacement, a rapid true polar wander, the pole was fixed, the Earth is sliding through the pole 180 degrees in a spiral. Now, what then happens, and this is a really strange thing which I write about in the book, because scientists, if you think, you probably know this, Whitley, when you say the Earth, the sun rose in the west and set in the east, most scientists would say, well, that's just dumb, because the only way that can happen is if the Earth stopped still and started rotating the opposite direction, which, you know, according to the laws of, you know, the conservation of angular momentum, that's just never going to happen. And I agree that and I accept that. But here's the thing. With this particular mechanism, which was actually originated by a guy called, a physicist called Peter Warlow. And what happens then is that with the pole remaining fixed and the Earth sliding basically through the pole up 180 degrees upside down, it actually ends up spinning in the same direction, but because it's now upside down, the sun will then appear to rise in the west and set in the east.
Now, that's an actual principle of physics that he discovered, of mechanical physics. Can you tell us the name of it? As I have it in my notes, but
It's the tippy top.
The tippy top effect, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now, which of these? Well, I will preface this next question just briefly. I'll start with my mother. Back in the 60s, the family has a country house north of San Antonio, which sits on a bluff overlooking a river. And there's a river valley there. It's not a very high bluff, maybe 60 or 70 feet. But it overlooks this valley, a farming valley, very quiet valley. And she believed that she had actually seen this river in such a flood that the flood filled the entire valley. And what was so bizarre about that is that she insisted it had actually happened, but it couldn't have. There would be no farms. The valley would have been stripped of everything. And when I pointed it out to her, she said, "Well, I'm sorry, it happened." And I think she might have been seeing the future, because she later on, 40 years later, I guess in more recent times, in the late 90s and early 2000s, I began to dream of huge floods. And I began to get letters from other close encounter witnesses who were having the same dreams. And this flood mythology is inside us somewhere. And I want to ask you, which of these different types of shift could cause the oceans to slosh out of their beds and sweep across the land?
Well, it would need to be, in my opinion, it would need to be, there's a couple of things that could happen. You could have the Earth turning over, and then as the Coptic Egyptian prophecy, it was a prophecy at the time, because the king's priests, astronomer priests, saw that the heavens were moving. And the king asked, "What does this mean?" And they said, "Well, it means in 300 years there will be a great flood which will completely destroy, our civilization. It will completely destroy the kingdom and everything in it." So they're saying, they knew that, well, they're seeing this pole shift actually happen. They're watching it happen. So it's happening relatively slowly. We would have to think if they're watching it happen. But then they're saying in 300 years' time, there'll be a devastating flood which will destroy everything. So that to me suggests that they have had information handed down from their ancestors that knew of these great cycles of the earth, and that when the earth does tilt like this, different parts, like the poles, the polar regions, the frozen polar regions, move into warmer latitudes of the earth. And what you have then, if you imagine this great ice sheet, the Cordilleran ice sheet, which was over North America, and the other one across Europe, supposedly 12,000 years ago. If you imagine that being subjected suddenly, relatively quickly, to massively increased temperatures, solar radiation, then that goes into a serious rapid meltdown. What you'll have is this massive, this incredible amount of water, lake, sea, whatever you want to call it, building up in the center of this, like a bowl like a massive bowl, a massive ice bowl, building up in the centre of this ice bowl, gradually, slowly melting over this 300 to 500 year period or whatever. Eventually, the pressure within the bowl becomes too great for the rim of the bowl to contain it any longer, and the rim of the bowl suddenly breaks. And what you then have is a torrent, an absolute torrent of water, just gushing over the landscape, tearing up everything in sight, you know, ripping mountains apart, you know, throwing 100-ton rocks everywhere. You know, it's just such, it's an unimaginable force we're talking about here. And it's probably, you're probably familiar with the Scablands in the northwest part of the United States, the channeled Scablands, discovered by J. Harlan Bretz. He realized that this ripple effect on the land, I think these ripples, now if you look at a beach, you can see small ripples in the sand. Well, these ripples that Harlan Bretz discovered were about 15 to 20 feet high, these ripples. Yes. You know, so you can imagine the scale of this flood that tore across, you know, Northwest America. Now, here's the thing, though, Whitley. What would happen when you've heard of the Zhanibekov effect, yeah? Have you heard of the Zhanibekov effect?
Yeah, and explain the Zhanibekov effect to us.
Yeah. Zhanibekov was a Russian cosmonaut. And in the 1980s, when he was repairing something, I think in Salyut 7 space station, Russian space station, he was unscrewing this handle from a bolt on the side of a panel within the space station. And what he did, he just gave it a quick dunt with his hand, and it spun off its mounting. It spun right off its mounting and kept on spinning in zero gravity through the length of the space station. But here's the thing. Zhanibekov noticed that every so often, at regular intervals, this handle, it was like a T-shape, you know, it was sort of a T-shape like that. It kept spinning all the way through the station, but suddenly it would flip over like that. And then it would flip 180 degrees with no outside torque or interference whatsoever. It would just do this by its own accord. Now,
just hold on a second. Guess what happened, folks? Just like what happened with the Chan book, the Russians classified this for 10 years, just as this, and maybe even for the same reason that the book was classified. And there's something going on that somebody, I think, would rather we not understand. And we're right there, right now. So go ahead.
Yeah, so the Russian government, as you say, quickly, they classified that discovery by Zhanibekov because they didn't understand it. But the curious thing was the mathematics behind it were actually already known. The mathematics behind the effect had been known since, I think, the early 19th century. And what it turns out is it's now referred to as you'll hear it described as the tennis racket theorem or the intermediate axis theorem those kind of terms. And basically, if something isn't designed perfectly, symmetrical, balanced, there's just a slight blemish on one of the axes of like this handle, then for whatever reason, when it spins in zero gravity, this imbalance causes this flipping motion. Now, scientists believe that because the Earth is a sphere, it only has one axis. It does not have an intermediary axis or a secondary axis from which there can develop an instability. So this is what they tell us. But then I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. If you have a massive amount of water, you know, unimaginable amount of water, a big bowl of it, and, you know, just think of the central landmass of the United States, you know, probably from like the Rockies right over to New York, you know, and take that as a huge big circle, all filling up with water, and then suddenly it breaks. What you then have is a sudden shift of mass. You have a sudden shift of mass going very rapidly from one place to another place on the planet. Now, that's hitting, that all that water is hitting the oceans. So you just simply cannot imagine the tsunamis and worldwide floods that that is going to cause. But I'm thinking also, Whitley, that, well, wait a minute, that is also going to induce a secondary rotational axis, an intermediary axis with this imbalance. And, you know, because this mass is suddenly going from there to there, you've got an imbalance in the Earth. And if you read the book, there's a chap called, I think he's a Spanish naval engineer, Spanish naval engineer, maybe it's Italian, but I think Spanish naval engineer, who developed this pole shift theory, whereby a massive amount of water, you know, suddenly shifting on the Earth can induce a pole shift in practically a day. You know, he shows the mathematics of it. You know, when you have a massive amount of water like that, and you know, I mean, we just cannot envisage, you know, the amount of massive water that this would have been. But he shows how this mass of water, Flavio Barbiero, that's his name, he shows how this mass amount of water shifting from one place to another can induce an instability in the Earth, which then can escalate into a full tilting of the Earth of 180 degrees. And he says it could occur in less than a day. Now, we see all these, this evidence about, you know, creatures' habitats instantly changing from temperate to frozen, frozen to temperate, almost instantaneously. Then, you know, this, you know, Zhanibekov effect could actually happen to the Earth, despite the reassurances of, you know, science that it can't.
Yeah, it seems clear that it happened during the time of Utsi the Iceman.
Yeah.
It happened, in fact, during the time of the Old Kingdom in Egypt.
Yep, absolutely. And I do go into that in the book, that there was a pole shift probably about 4,500 to 5,000 years ago.
Well, free Dreamlanders, we have to say goodbye to you now. And in the next half hour, we're going to be talking about the when and the not. We've been talking about the why. We're going to be talking about the when. Does this mean anything to us now? And what is in that void? Because Scott's got some very specific and very well worked out ideas about what we may find there and the extraordinary meaning it might have for us. Scott Peyton's book is The Great Pyramid Void Enigma, The Mystery of the Hall of the Ancestors. He is also the author of The Great Pyramid Hoax and was on William Henry's show, Revelations. I mentioned Scott had been on Dreamland earlier. That's not correct. He was on Revelations. Yeah. And in a two-week show with William Henry, back, I believe, in 2012. So it's been a long time, but it's also a wonderful show. So if you'd like to get more deeply into the pyramid hoax and the mystery of the Giza Plateau, continue listening today and get into Scott's previous shows on unknowncountry.com by simply searching on the word Creighton, C-R-E-I-G-H-T-O-N. Free Dreamlanders, thank you as always for being with us. Now, Scott, we have something that happened 5,000 years ago, and apparently something different happened 12,000 years ago. Because there's a book called The Cycle of Cosmic Catastrophes by Richard Firestone, Alan West, and Simon Warwick Smith that describes pretty much with great exactitude what happened 12,000 years ago. And it was a terrible event. We have a lot of geological evidence of its happening. What happened was there was a flood over the whole of the North American continent. The native population was completely wiped out, except in the Pacific Northwest. When the flood receded, first there was a fire, the continental fire, then a flood. Then when the flood receded, it left algae skeletons and ash all over the ground, which is now known in geology as the black mat. And it's all over much of North America. The camels, the horses, the ground sloths, the mammoths, all of the large animals of North America were annihilated at that time. And geologically, it's so recent that there are caves in the Grand Canyon where you can find giant ground sloth manure still on the floor of the caves. And of course, all those people disappeared. Graham Hancock makes the point in more than one of his books that this is a really dangerous planet. And I think you would agree wholeheartedly with him. Now, let's talk about what might have happened to the Old Kingdom, to Utsi, to the Peruvian Andes. What might have happened then? What do the Egyptians tell us about that period?
Okay, well, I think first of all, it's probably worth saying first up here, Whitley, is that I believe the pyramids, we're talking about the Great Pyramids here, not the later, smaller sort of imitation type pyramids. I suspect that the Great Pyramids, the giant pyramids, the ones that came first, were built way, way, way before 5,000 years ago. I believe they are about 12,000 years old. Now, we know, you just discussed it there, we know from science now, and the evidence is becoming indisputable now, that some major cataclysm, some absolutely monumental catastrophic event occurred on this planet, to this planet, about 12,000 years ago. The science is just overwhelming. Yeah.
And, yes.
Graham Hancock documents it thoroughly, as do many people in the scientific community as well. West, Firestone, Smith. So we know something devastating happened. That's beyond question. Now, here's the thing. The ancient Egyptian, Coptic Egyptian texts tell us that King Saurid, which may be a corruption of the name Sufis, which is the Greek word for Khufu, who is Egyptology believes was a builder of the Great Pyramid. Now, Saurid, he saw that the stars and sky were moving out of the place, as we discussed earlier, And he asked his astronomers, priests, what does this mean? They said, it will mean a great flood will destroy the kingdom. I think they also mentioned fire as well. And what Saurid said was, okay, what we're going to do is build pyramids. And we're going to put everything in these pyramids that we will need to reboot the kingdom again after the worst effects of this devastating flood have passed. So that is what the Coptic Egyptians... Now, the word Copt actually means Egypt.
So right, they are the ancient Egyptians.
They are the ancient Egyptians, yes. You know. But the issue here, a lot of people dismiss the Coptic legends because, oh, well, they're just Christians. You know, how could they possibly know? Christianity was only formed about 2,000 years ago, so how could Copts know something 2,500 years before then, according to them?
You mentioned, though, some very interesting things about the Great Pyramid that support the Coptic legends. One is the watermark that was on the casing of the pyramid before it was destroyed. But the other is the dating of shells and so forth that are found lodged in the between the stones now. Can you tell us a little bit about those things?
Yeah. Over the years, various researchers, we have to imagine when this flood occurred, there would be like great mounds of earth piled up, around these monuments. And it seems that, according to these legends, the Great Pyramids were actually submerged in water to about two-thirds of their height, something in that order, which would have made the smaller of the three pyramids completely underwater, along with the Sphinx. So these great pyramids, as what have got different water lines. The Great Pyramid has been noted by various ancient writers to have had different water lines where the flood waters had risen to. And as the waters receded, you know, they stayed a bit longer, a bit lower down, and there was a line at that point. But also we find inside the Queen's Chamber, the walls, when modern science first got into the Queen's Chamber, the walls were encrusted with salt. Now, this wasn't, limestone itself and the chambers consisted of limestone blocks. Limestone can exude salt. But the salt that was detected in the limestone was apparently sea salt. It wasn't, which is a different chemical composition than the limestone salt. So there you go. I mean, are these legends true? Well, I don't see any reason why anyone could make something like that up. It was found, was tested. So why can't people accept that the pyramids, up to the level at least of the Queen's Chamber, which is probably about maybe just about a third of the way up, maybe a bit more, was submerged in water, seawater.
Right.
You just have, and there's all sorts of other, there's a chap called Cher Morsi, and he's been all around Giza looking for evidence of a great flood, and he's found a ton of evidence on the Giza Plateau. If you look at the limestone blocks on the Great Pyramid, these blocks, you can see the water erosion on these blocks. You can see the water erosion on the Sphinx, and that's an argument as well that's been raging for long enough. But what he also found on the down towards the third, the smaller of the three Great Pyramids, at the mortuary temple there, sitting on top of the wall of the mortuary temple, which is probably about maybe 10 or 12 feet high, he found this exoskeleton of an urchin, a complete exoskeleton. Of a sea urchin. Sitting, sitting and, you know, embedded into this, not fully embedded, you know, the rock, you know, had basically eroded a bit at the top. And there was this perfect exoskeleton of this sea urchin sitting or embedded into the top of this wall. Now,
so what you're saying is there was a flood there, and when it happened, the pyramids were there.
Yeah,
the Sphinx must have been too.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And that could be part of the account. And that happened 12,000 years ago.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So they were already built then.
They were built, the first pole shift, which I recount in the book, occurred about 12,000 years ago, about 10,081 BC. And that's roughly when it occurred. And shortly thereafter, when the pole shift was occurring, they were anticipating this flood in about great flood in about 300 years from their time. And the king said, "We're going to build pyramids so that our civilization, our kingdom, can be reborn again after this flood." And you know, this all ties in with actually Whitley with, you know, ancient Egyptian creation myths. It all ties in with the myth of Isis and Osiris. You know, it's all the same event, that the pyramid texts, the creation myths, the Isis and Osiris myths, it's all about the same event. And you know, it just gets overlooked, which I find a bit frustrating, but it gets overlooked. And this is what I try to do in the book, is I try to join up all these different dots. You know, I mean, you'll have seen in the book, Whitley, there's this icon or hieroglyphic of the pyramid. And the pyramid hieroglyphic is a triangle, yeah. Triangle, but it's not just a triangle, it's sitting on a small rectangular base. Yeah. And Egyptologists say, well, that's just the perimeter wall around the pyramid, because pyramids supposedly had this very low perimeter wall. But, you know, comparative to this pyramid hieroglyph, you know, it's a very, very big wall. But anyway, my view is that the great pyramid is called Akhet, Khufu. The word Akhet means flood. The word Khufu means protect. So the flood
now,
protector.
Let's just talk about, what's his name?
William Weiss.
Weiss, who very appropriately named in some way, who allegedly discovered in, I believe, 1837, after blasting his way into untouched areas of the pyramid, discovered the name Khufu written in a sealed chamber. Is that the truth?
No.
I'm glad you answered it so straightforwardly.
No, it's true that he claims he discovered it, but the truth of whether he placed it there or it was discovered is, in my opinion, it was not there when Weiss entered that sealed chamber.
I see. And so it was basically forged in order to create a sensation that would justify all of the work that they had been doing.
Well, Colonel Weiss spent something in the order of $1.3 million in today's money, yeah, on his explorations at the Great Pyramid. And he didn't find very much. And you can tell by reading through, he wrote three volumes of his time in Egypt from December 1835 to, I think, August 1837, something like that. And in these three volumes, You can tell by reading through them that he was desperate to make a really important discovery. He wanted to find the true burial chamber of Khufu. That's what he wanted to do. And he failed. He thought, he certainly discovered, because personally I think he was apparently told by his work colleague at the time, his business associate at the time, a chap called Giovanni Cavaglia, that there was these hidden chambers inside or above the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid. And Cavaglia discovered this because there's one of these chambers that we know of that has always been open since the pyramid was built. It's called Davidson's Chamber. It was discovered by Nathaniel Davidson in the mid to late 18th century, I think 1765 or 69, something like that. He discovered this small chamber above, directly over the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid. And it's named after him. Now, what Cavaglia did, he lived in there. Cavaglia actually lived in this small chamber within the Great Pyramid. Now, you have to understand, to get to this chamber, this small chamber above the King's Chamber, you have to go to the top of the Grand Gallery, and then there's a 30-foot-high wall there, and you have to get a ladder, 30-foot ladder, that takes you up to the top of this wall. And right in the very corner at the top of this wall, there's a small, I think it's 2-foot by 2-foot opening, which you can squeeze yourself through, and it takes you into this Davidson's Chamber. So Cavaglia lived there, and one day he took a reed of grass, a long stem of grass, and he poked it through this a gap between the ceiling blocks above his head. And it went all the way through, and he lit a candle, and he was sure he could see that there was another chamber above. So he told Weiss this, and very shortly thereafter, Weiss somehow managed to manufacture some excuse to have Cavaglia kicked off the site and barred permanently from the site, and Weiss went on to discover these chambers himself.
Ah, I see.
So,
well, you know, it occurred to me that given the meaning of the word Khufu, it could be that the inscription was there in red ochre paint, but it was misunderstood. In other words, the pyramid's real name is Flood Protector.
Yeah.
And well, so go ahead.
Yeah, well, what Egyptologists tell us is that this name Khufu, it wasn't just Khufu itself. It was a sentence. It was a sentence with the word Khufu in it. And this sentence was essentially the pure ones of Khufu, of Majedu, the powerful white crown of Khufu. That, you know, these were names of, supposedly the names of the quarry gangs that quarried these stones. And what they would do is they would put a mark, it's almost like an address of who this stone was to be delivered to, which gang it was to be delivered to at the Great Pyramid site once it got up to the Great Pyramid, because it would go to a particular gang, because particular gangs were responsible for particular parts of the monument, for building particular parts of the monument. So they wanted the right stones to go to the right people. So that supposedly is what these inscriptions were, addresses, yeah? And, you know, so these gangs called themselves various names, and that's what are on, apparently, on these stones. And, you know, they're the only places within the Great Pyramid where we see any marks whatsoever. Not even in the chamber below it, Davidson's Chamber, which I said has been open for thousands since the pyramid was built. There's none of these marks in this chamber, which is identical to these other four. The only places we find these marks are in the four chambers that Weiss blasted open with gunpowder.
Well, folks, you see me with a new microphone, and the reason is I had one of those Dreamland electronic events. The microphone failed suddenly in this brand new microphone,
This microphone, however, I don't think it will fail. It has been with me for more than 20 years. It's a wonderful mic, and I'm going to keep using it because Scott could not hear my questions. And he, while his answers were brilliant, I did have a couple of other questions. And let's do that now. The first question, Scott, is going to be, what's in that void? And how, and it perhaps relates somewhat to the second question, which is, given the rapid polar melt that's happening on both poles now, and all of that ice turning to water and moving toward the equator, could we be in for another shift of some kind? And if so, which kind? Okay, so let's first talk about the void and what you believe to be in it.
Okay. Well, I think to explain what's in the void, we need to step back just a little bit quickly to understand the ancient Egyptian religion. Now, remember, they're building this pyramid to ensure that they can recover from this catastrophe that's coming their way several centuries down the road. Now, what they would be doing is they would be putting everything inside the Great Pyramid, like a vault. They'd be putting all manner of seed types, all manner of seeds, agricultural tools. They would be putting in their knowledge, weapons, pots, you name. They'd be putting everything inside these monuments, these structures, in order to reseed their kingdom. Now, I'm not saying here they're putting enough grain or whatever to feed the population. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying they did what our civilization is doing right now with the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, which has been built in case there's some catastrophe occurs on the Earth and, you know, it's completely destroyed and we need to reseed it again. So they put copies of all the seeds, plants of the earth into this vault in Svalbard Island in the Norwegian archipelago. So it's basically to ensure that the earth can recover from any cataclysm. So the ancient Egyptians did what our own civilization is doing right now. They saw this event happening, so that's what they did. Now, the problem is the king had to be preserved, the king, because this is why ancient Egyptians mummified. Mummification was so important to the ancient Egyptians, is because the king actually, in essence, was more important in death than he was in life, because In death, he would intercede with the gods, he would commune with the gods to ensure that the Nile would flow, the crops would grow, the sun would rise, you know, so forth and so on, that what is called mat or balance would continue and it would keep isfet or chaos away. So this is what the king's role was in death, was to commune with the gods for the benevolence of the kingdom and the people. That was their role. However, if the king's body decayed or was destroyed in any way, then this couldn't happen. And if that were the case, then it could bring chaos to the kingdom. Now imagine you're in a situation where you know there's some catastrophic event coming your way that will completely eradicate your kingdom. All your ancestors are going to, that you rely upon to commune with the gods for the benefit of the kingdom, they're all going to be destroyed as well in this gigantic flood that's going to tear up the entire kingdom. And so this is what the Coptic Egyptian texts tell us. Khufu put everything in the pyramid that the kingdom needed to reboot itself, including his ancestors.
So we have but the thing is, the pyramid was there before the flood, because otherwise those watermarks wouldn't exist on it, have existed. The evidence is pretty strong, isn't it?
Yeah, they built the pyramid before this flood event arrived.
Yes, and therefore whatever's in that void was put in there then.
It was put in the void as the pyramid was being built.
Yes. Yep. But Khufu is from a late Old Kingdom pharaoh, long after this flood took place.
This is what I explain in the book. Egyptology always asks Graham Hancock and Robert Bavall, well, so is a potsherd of this lost civilization. Yeah, that's the canard. The trope that's always, passed on to people like Graham Hancock and Robert Bavall and other alternative thinkers. In my opinion, it's not the civilization that's been lost. It's the time that's been lost. The Great Pyramid and its builder are much older than the fourth dynasty.
So if we find mummies in that void, they're going to be much older than any mummies we've ever found before.
Yeah, yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay, and I won't go into one of the stranger things you point out in the book, which is that many of the sealed royal coffins, when opened, are found empty.
Yeah.
Which, of course, I just wrote a book called Jesus, A New Vision, about why his tomb was found empty. And I have a feeling that when the pharaohs were thought to return to the stars, that something very extraordinary actually did happen, and that the secret of that was passed down, ending with Jesus. But that's another show. We're not going to go down that road now, but just folks know that I know that exists and I'm working on doing a show about it. Now, I want to know about what may happen. Could any of these types of event be triggered by the alteration in the weight distribution of the oceans that's going on right now?
I think if there is a sudden massive deluge, and it's not evenly spread, it's not gradual, it's not even, then it's not, the Earth doesn't have time to recover from any disturbance. If, however, there were, let's say, an iceberg, half of Antarctica suddenly split away and started drifting towards the equator, then that ice isn't going to melt, before, if we imagine that land, that mass of ice could get to the equator. So you've got an imbalance on the Earth. It's all about balance. It's all about the Earth maintaining balance. If there's a sudden massive shift of water from one part of the Earth to another, and it's sudden, that will create an imbalance which the Earth won't have time to recover from. And so that will create a self-perpetuating imbalance that will eventually result in a polar shift.
In other words, that could happen. And also that effect we discussed a moment ago, I've put my notes down somewhere else. The things have been rather chaotic around here, folks, in the past half hour because of failures.
Technology.
But anyway, the effect that was discovered by the Russian astronaut, could that happen again?
Well,
unexpectedly.
Well, this is, I what I argue in the book is, Whitley, is that I think this happens because the Earth is not a solid object. It's not a solid object. You know, it's fluid. You know, its mass moves around. You know,
yeah, that's right. You're floating basically on a molten core.
Yeah, absolutely. It can move around, and its surface has water, which can shift around as well. Especially, as I said, if you have, like I explained earlier in the show, if you have a massive ice sheet which suddenly is containing all this water within the bowl, and then the edge of the bowl breaks, you've got that weight suddenly moving, suddenly shifting from one part of the Earth to another, creating this imbalance. So this is what I mean. You know, it's about it's all about balance. If there's a sudden balance, and incidentally, Whitley, it doesn't need necessarily to be water. A small asteroid, this is what Flavio Barbiero also talks about, a small, relatively small asteroid, I think about a quarter of a mile in diameter, hitting the ocean could trigger the Zhanibekov effect, because it's this imbalance. It creates an intermediary axis, a second axis of rotation on the Earth. And if the Earth can't rebound back from it quick enough, it naturally has to follow through, and it tips over this 180 degrees that we see in these Zhanibekov videos in the Salyut 7 space station.
Well, okay. We've gone, I think, as far as we can. We know that something could happen. A lot of us close encounter witnesses sense that it may happen fairly soon. We don't have dates. There are various indications that the intelligence community may be concerned about it, with their habit of making books disappear that talk about these things. So the Great Pyramid Void Enigma, the mystery of the Hall of the Ancestors. Let's wait and see what happens when that hall begins to be to explored. And Scott, what are the plans that are being formed to explore that?
Yeah, well, the plans have kind of been put on the back burner for the last year or so.
Of course.
Yeah, because of COVID and so forth and so on. So they were supposed to have been analyzing it last year in 2020, and they were going to release results I think last autumn, but I think that has been postponed probably maybe till this autumn if we're lucky. They're up in these vice chambers, the very top chamber, they're up there, and one of the ideas is to drill horizontally through the roof of the King's Chamber, which is roughly at the top of the big void. So they're going to drill horizontally. I don't think they fancy the idea too much of drilling vertically, because then they could have all the sand pouring out or whatever.
You know. Right, exactly.
And Indiana Jones, a big ball will appear and chase everybody out. But no, so I think they're trying to drill horizontally into the big void and place some form of endoscopic camera or whatever, if they can actually drill through to it, to feed an endoscopic camera into it to have a look around. So that's, I think, kind of the initial ideas that have been floated around. But it's interesting that Zahi Hawass and the American Egyptologist Mark Lehner have both, you know, dismissed this big void when it was first announced, and they are now saying that, well, you know, this really could contain something really significant.
So we will eagerly await this discovery and hope that we are told what is actually there, if it's not what the conventional Egyptologists expected to see. And that jury remains out. Scott Creighton, thank you so much for being with us on Dreamland.
It's been a pleasure, Whitley. It's good to speak to you again after all these years.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.